broadcasting from the campus of Salisbury University. This is WSDL Ocean City 90.7 FM, Delmarva Public Radio. It's time now for a special writer's edition of Delmarva Today with host Harold Wilson.
We are aboard Air Force One en route to California. When I began briefing President Barack Obama on the strategic review of American policy toward Afghanistan and Pakistan, he had asked me to do. Seated behind his wood desk in the president's cabin, Obama listened closely, asking many questions. Now we are walking from Air Force One to a waiting Marine helicopter. I drew the president's attention to the review's central conclusion: Pakistan, the birthplace of global jihad, Islamic jihad, and now its epicenter, had become a crucible of terror and was the most dangerous country in the world. Clearly, it held the key to destroying both Al-Qaeda and the larger syndicate. Bruce Rydell, in his book, Deadly Embrace. Welcome to Delmarva Today, Writer's Edition. I'm your host, Harold Wilson. We're very pleased to welcome Bruce Rydell to our studio today to discuss his work as a policy analyst and his three books, The Search for Al-Qaeda, Deadly Embrace, Pakistan, America and the Future of the Global Jihad, and Avoiding Armageddon, America, India, and Pakistan, To the Brink and Back. Because of his direct interest in current affairs, I've also asked Don Rush, news director for Delmarva Public Radio, to join in our discussion today. Welcome to Delmarva Today, Writer's Edition, Bruce.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
And Don, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for sitting in.
Bruce Rydell is Senior Fellow and Director of the Brookings Intelligence Project, which is part of Brookings Institution's new Center for 21st Century Security and Intelligence. He also serves as a Senior Fellow in the Sabin Center for Middle East Policy. Bruce joined Brookings following a 30-year career at the Central Intelligence Agency. His tenure there included multiple overseas postings. Bruce also served as senior advisor to the last four U.S. presidents on South Asia and the Middle East while working as a senior member of the National Security Council. Bruce also teaches at the Johns Hopkins University School for Advanced International Studies. He is a graduate of Brown University, Harvard University, and the Royal College of Defense Studies in London. Bruce is also a recipient of the Intelligence Medal of Merit and the Distinguished Intelligence Career Medal. Bruce, you've certainly had a distinguished career for such a young man. How did you choose to become interested in the Middle East and South Asia?
It's a family affair. My father, after serving in World War II, joined the United Nations when it was a very early beginnings. And he was posted to Jerusalem, which was then under the Jordanian control, and then to Beirut. So I grew up, my formative years before the age of 10 were spent in Jerusalem and in Beirut. And I got caught by the magic of the Middle East, like many others. The intrigue and the interest of the Arab world, the Islamic world. And once it's in you, you're pretty much stuck with it for the rest of your life. It doesn't go away.
And so you've made a career of writing about, of studying and writing about this region of the country. Well, let me say that Soren Kierkegaard, in his journals, tells us that every action is preceded by a certain understanding. And I take that to mean that every writer works for some basic perspective. What is the basic perspective or the basic idea that brings you to your work on this area of our world that has so captured you?
I think it's a combination of two things. One, I'm a historian by training. When I went to Brown and Harvard, my life's goal was to be a history professor. My advisor at Harvard, after 2 years and a lot of money, took me aside and said, you know, there's no jobs in this. You're not going to make a living as a history professor. I advise you to go to the Central Intelligence Agency. They actually will pay you. And I took his advice. But I've always wanted to be the historian that I started out. Secondly, it's cultural understanding. I think that as this planet becomes smaller in many ways, or as there are more and more of us, the critical imperative to understand each other's cultures, each other's religion, way of life, becomes the imperative of the 21st century. We cannot afford to have another century like the 20th century with unending wars. We have to understand each other, empathize with each other better. And the part of the world that I know about the most, I've spent a lifetime studying, the Middle East and South Asia is an area we particularly need to understand the history, the culture, and empathize with the people. And that's what I try to do in the books that I've written, is explain clearly the history and the consequences of decisions that we have made as Americans in interacting with the people of Pakistan, India, Afghanistan, Iran, and the rest of South Asia and the Middle East.
So part of what you weren't to impart with your writing is to have people realize that when they read about and even remember themselves specific events, particularly historical events, that they need to take some kind of position. They need to analyze and ask themselves what these events mean for them and what they mean for the future. And you're providing them, am I right here, then you're providing him a context in your writing within which to do that.
Absolutely. Let's turn to the event of our time that everyone was shaped by, the attack on the United States on September 11th, 2001. The universal question that evening and the next day and the year since is, why do they hate us? Why did they do this? Well, there are reasons why they hate us, and there's a history to how we got to September 11th that's very important to understand. That's not to justify an act of murder, which is what September 11th was. It's to try to understand it, and through understanding it, get a better understanding of how we can avoid similar occurrences in the future. That will include hard power that we will use to kill and capture terrorists, but it will also include soft power to deny them the roots of the anger that they were able to use against us then. September 11th is one example, and there are many, many others. And I think that this isn't ancient history. This is history that's alive for everybody in Maryland, in the United States today, and across the world. And a better understanding of that history can be done in 200 pages. You can read my books on a lengthy airplane flight. I try to keep them short enough so that you're not going to put them aside and say, I'll come back to that someday, and never do. I try to keep it short, I hope punchy, and to the point.
You mentioned hard power and you mentioned soft power. What is hard power in your understanding, and what is soft power, and how would you see that they should be applied?
Well, let's look at it from the perspective of the White House, of an American president. He has at his command the largest military in the history of the world. Maybe not in terms of number of people, but in terms of budget. That's the largest military in human history. He can order a drone to attack someone on the other side of the world. He can order SEALs to take helicopters into the heart of Pakistan and get Osama bin Laden. But if that's all he does, he's really missing a significant part of his power. As the president of the United States, he has soft power. He has the ability to speak to the world, to explain what he's doing, to justify what he's doing, to try to encourage others in what they need to do, the bully pulpit of the White House. I think great presidents and great leaders everywhere, but presidents are what I'm familiar with, are the ones who know how to use both. Hard power when they have to, and soft power when that's going to be more effective and have a longer lasting impact. And the combination of doing those two is the policy relevance in the end of the books produced by the Brookings Institution have to have policy relevance at some point. That's what we are. We're a think tank that advises presidents, advises the country in general. So there has to be a relevance at the end and an explanation of how to use the various powers the presidency in the United States has.
It sounds to me like soft power is an ongoing power, that it's not something that is applied at the particular moment, but to be effective, soft power is an ongoing approach.
Absolutely. It's not a one-speech deal. and unfortunately, too often it becomes, well, I gave a speech on that. That box is checked. We don't need to go back to that. Soft power in many ways is the reflection of actual action. Let me give you an example. If you want to convince the peoples of the Middle East that the United States is serious about promoting an Israeli-Palestinian peace process, you can give a speech. But if you don't actually do something about it, if you don't actually bring them together, negotiate, and hammer something out, the speech pretty soon becomes not an act of positive good, but hypocrisy. People will say, oh yeah, you talk about it. What did you ever do about it? So soft power to work isn't just words. It's not just op-eds. It's not just speeches. It's actually doing something that you can then point to and say, I'm serious about this. I got Prime Minister Netanyahu and Abu Mazen to sit down together, and here we have a framework agreement. If you don't have it, sooner or later, all the fancy speeches in the world aren't going to do you any good.
Well, I was going to ask you for an example of that kind of soft power. Can you pick an example of Afghanistan or Pakistan or whatever you would like, even Israel, for instance, and the Palestinians, and give us an example that you see of the use of that kind of soft power.
Certainly. I think the Clinton administration is a very good example. The peace process between Israelis and Palestinians had begun in the Bush administration. President Bush convened the Madrid conference. Secretly, the Israelis and Palestinians had a back channel, the so-called Oslo process. President Clinton endorsed and accepted that process, even though it had been kind of done behind his back. He bought into it, and then he built on it. And by demonstrating that the United States could be the instrument by which Israelis and Palestinians move towards a better future, the soft power eroded the strength of terrorist groups who were desperate to stop it and took actions to stop it. Now, in the end, it didn't work. It didn't work in the 1990s. I think that President Obama is wise today, and Secretary Kerry in particular, to be back at it, to trying to make it work. Because a peace process that produces a tangible outcome will be the most effective kind of soft power, and in the long run, do much more to protect us against the anger and frustration that produces terrorism than all the drones in the world.
So let me turn to your writing then, and how you express your approach to power, for instance, and particularly soft power, and how you approach what you want people to get out of your analysis of this kind of political activity. You've written three books now. You've got a couple of more in the works, I understand. And you've also written hundreds of policy reviews and articles and papers. How tell us a little bit from a writing perspective. How do you organize your books? How do you organize your approach to presenting what can be very, very complex concepts and ideas, and have people think about them and realize that there are decisions that they need to make that come out of these, and that decisions, in fact, have consequences?
I have a formula. I call it my Agatha Christie formula. And that is that if you're going to write a book, it's a lot like writing a murder mystery. You need to know who did it. Who is the murderer? You need to, before you start page one, know how you're going to conclude the book. Or as my analogy goes, you need to know who Hercule Poirot is going to point at in the final scene of the book and say, aha, he's the murderer. If you know that part, then everything else is relatively easy, because you're just building up to that point. So in writing my books, I try to do an outline, very short, one page literally, that tells me how I'm going to go from page one to the denouement where the murderer is revealed in the last chapter. In my case, it's not a murderer. It's going to be, here's what I think is the most effective way to resolve this issue or contain this issue or to change this issue in a positive direction. And I'm going to try to march the reader through recent history or not so recent history so that he and she see how I got to my conclusion at the end. I also realized, though, along the way that policy discussions and history can be often dull to readers.
Oh, come on, Bruce.
It's true. It can, in the hands of brilliant writers, it's one thing.
Such as yourself, frankly.
I'm not a brilliant writer, but I do realize that you have to have some atmospherics, right? You don't want to give one date after another in a kind of a diary, you know. There are a lot of memoirs that are like that. I don't want to pick on any ones in particular, but a lot of memoirs are basically, I got up, I had breakfast, I met with so-and-so, I met with so-and-so, I had lunch. Gets pretty deadly. So in addition to having the chronology and walking you through an issue to understand it, I think it's useful to have a little bit of atmospherics, especially at the opening and closing of the chapters of the book. And atmospherics are usually better if you can put yourself in them. You remember them better. So, for example, the quotation you read at the beginning of the news hour about going with President Obama on Air Force One to California. I think it's an interesting story. It was an honor to be there. And I think it helps to draw the reader in to finding out, how did he get on the plane? Why was he on the plane? What does he think? That kind of thing.
Well, let me make a comment here. I've read your three books that are out. I've not had an opportunity to read policy papers, or I'm not in that elevated circle of readers of yours. But I've read your three books, and I want to say that from the search for Al-Qaeda through Deadly Embrace, the book about Pakistan, and then your last book that's out, Avoiding Armageddon, I really found a shift, and if you would respond to this, I really think I found a shift in the literary quality, which I think speaks to what you were just saying. I read in the opening chapter Avoiding Armageddon, you describe looking out the hotel window at Mumbai, I think it is, and there's a literary quality to that paragraph that really places us in the city of Mumbai, and in your mind, the person who is there, I believe it was with the president, with Clinton, I think.
That's right.
To do some work in that city. Are you aware, or were you conscious of the progression, or am I reading something in here that isn't there?
Well, I like to think I'm getting better at this, that you learn from everything you do. When I left government and came to the Brookings Institution, I had written in a certain style for 30 years. If you write a memo for the President of the United States, there's not a lot of room for atmospherics and background. It's usually a page long, so you can't weave in humorous anecdotes. Unless you type very, very small print. When I came to Brookings, I stayed in that menu of trying to keep it as crisp and policy relevant as possible. As time has gone on, I've discovered that I think readers like to have more of the context. And that frees you to write in a more literary way. You don't have to be so punchy in everything. You can still make the point. You can still have a policy relevance, but you can provide the ambiance that I think makes for a much more literary approach.
Well, the context. We need to be there.
Right.
And we need to be a participant in the room for it to draw interest from us. And we need to be in your head as well. So we need to know a little bit. And you certainly achieved that. I think you achieved that. Don, jump in here, Ryan, if you would.
Well, I was curious about the Arab Spring and how you assess it, because it seems to have had mixed results. I mean, there seems to be some progress in Tunisia. On the other hand, we look at Egypt, where we had an election. The military then took over after the Muslim Brotherhood won, after what some people say was a disastrous administration of just the state itself. What do you see the impact of this Arab Spring, and where is it going?
The first thing that I always remind people about the Arab Spring, nobody saw it coming. I know there are people after the fact who claimed they wrote an article or something which predicted the Arab Spring. I haven't seen anyone convincingly make that case. So the first thing about the Arab Spring I think one bears in mind is humility. If you didn't see where it was coming, you shouldn't be too quick to be the first to explain where it's going. The Arab Spring had many, many causes, but the fundamental cause is a simple one. Every Arab country is a police state. Some of them are a little more benign than others. Some were at the extreme end of brutality, like Gaddafi's Libya or Saddam's Iraq. What happened in 2011 is the Arabs got tired of living in police states, and they want to move towards something which most of the rest of us have been living in, whether it's democracy or at least reformists, where freedom of expression is allowed and tolerated. The problem is that these police states are in some cases 5,000 years old, like Egypt. Egypt has been a police state since the first pharaoh, 3000 BC. And you don't go from being a police state to being Maryland with its democratic traditions, its culture of tolerance overnight. And what we're seeing is this is going to be a long, long road. And the forces of reaction, the police and those who benefited from the old system, are going to fight back. And they're fighting back. And in Syria, they're literally fighting back with a civil war. And in Egypt, they fought back with a military coup. I think the Arab Spring cannot really be judged a success or a failure until decades from now.
Do you think that the kind of turmoil that we're seeing, that obviously we're seeing an upending of dictatorships, but when you get these massive votes, for instance, in Egypt, Muslim Brotherhood, well organized, they were to come to power, and there is a sense in that part of the world that you do fuse religious beliefs, mm-hmm. Islam, with the state. And it's something that sounds to me like that's what they're beginning to grapple with, and I don't know whether they're going to let go. I mean, I was reading the other day that there's hints in Iran. There are some people who are now talking about it in Iran, about separating out the religious from the secular state. What sense, I mean, where do you see them going?
It's a very difficult process to do. The Islamic religion is fused between religion and practical politics. Here's some history is really useful. The Prophet Muhammad, who inspired the Islamic religion, was not just a prophet. He was the governor of a state. He ran the state. So consequently, he not only spoke about theology, he practiced the rules of politics. In a sense, from birth, Islam is much more interrelated between the secular political world and the religious world than, say, Christianity or Judaism is. I think that's helpful in knowing when you look at contemporary events in the Middle East. Leaders in the Muslim world, particularly religious leaders like the Muslim Brotherhood or the Ayatollahs who run Iran, don't see the division between secular and religious that we see. They see these things as much more fused together. Now, you're also right that increasingly there is understanding that that's not going to produce the kind of tolerant societies that some people want to see, and that there's going to have to be more division between God's world and the political world. Again, it's going to be a process that's going to take, it's not going to be resolved in months, years, maybe not even in decades, maybe in several decades. And that's the difficulty of what's going on. And when you tear down a police state, if you don't have something to replace it, you create chaos. And in the chaos that we're seeing in the Middle East today, unfortunately, Al-Qaeda and other extremist groups are exploiting this chaotic moment. And that's why you see the development of more and more of these Al-Qaeda affiliates across the Middle East, taking advantage of the chaos that has come with the breakdown in law and order, that it was an unintended consequence of these revolutionary movements.
Well, final follow-up on this, which is that one of the other dynamics that seems to me to be played out is the Sunni-Shiite division. I mean, that one of the most significant things that seems to me about the 1975 revolution in Iran, where here was the Shiites who came to the head of a state. And it now seems as if after the Arab Spring, after this sort of breakdown, we're now seeing this division that's occurred, certainly in Syria, for example, where you see Iran who are Shiite backing Assad. You've got Al-Qaeda, who happens to be Sunni in nature, backing the rebels. So there seems to be this division that's playing out, not only in Syria, but certainly Iraq and so on. Where do you see that dynamic? How do you see that dynamic playing out?
Oh, we're going to take a short break. When we come back, Bruce, we'll continue the conversation on Iran and particularly the Sunni-Shiite split and what that means for the region. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Have you ever heard an idea that changed the way you look at the world?
Everything we think,
we've
we
had
feel.
To believe in impossible things.
Infinite possibility, that sense of potential. And I realize
we've had to refuse
persist.
To fear failure.
You've got to persist through failure.
You can contemplate the meaning of infinity.
I'm Guy Raz. Join me each week for Ideas Worth Spreading on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
Sunday morning at 10 on WSDL.
Hi, I'm Bea Barnett from The Pick, a new radio show featuring a fresh variety of rock, pop, and soul. You'll hear great music from today, some classic tracks, and some surprises you might have missed over the last few decades. Most of all, we never forget that the whole point of rock and roll radio is to have fun together. There's life beyond Top 40 and so much beyond the greatest hits. Tune into The Pick right here on Delmarva Public Radio.
Weeknights beginning at 9 on WSDL 90.7 FM, Rhythm and News.
Welcome back to Delmarva Today, Writer's Edition. I'm your host, Harold Wilson. Today we're talking to Bruce Rydell, Senior Fellow and Director of the Brookings Intelligence Project. Joining us at the table also is Don Rush from Delmarva Public Radio. Don left you with a very interesting question, Bruce. Can you pick up on that for us?
Sure. The division in Islam between the majority sect, which are Sunnis, and the minority sect, which are Shia, is being exploited in our time by political leaders in the Arab world and in Iran as a weapon against their enemies. Whenever you have upheaval and turmoil and you want to portray the struggle as us against the them, painting the them as being deviants from the true religion is one of the oldest games in the book. We know it from our own cultural history, the 30 Years' War in Germany in the 17th century. And unfortunately, I think that's what's going on here. A lot of political leaders eager to hang on to political power are using sectarian divisions. It's particularly disturbing to watch because the Sunni-Shia divide in Islam is not over some great theological issue. This isn't a quarrel about the divinity or the nature of divine revelation. This is really a question over the succession to the Prophet Muhammad 1,600 years ago. It's a little bit like fighting over which pope should have come in the 7th century. It has developed bigger and deeper meanings over time, but the root of the quarrel is basically a political succession struggle. And that doesn't make any sense to kill someone over who became the leader of the Islamic world in the 6th century, in the 21st century. But it's being used by people, as sectarian divisions are often used, in order to enhance political power.
Bruce, in continuing our discussion on Iran, particularly that Don raised, you wrote the foreword to what seems to me to be a very important book called Becoming Enemies. And it's an analysis of U.S.-Iran relations and the Iran-Iraq War from 1979 to 1988. And the book uses a method called critical oral history. It was developed, I understand, to study flashpoints such as the Cuban Missile Crisis. And the work clearly has an implication for our political approach to Iran today, which is very much in the news. Tell us a little bit about what critical oral history is and the work that you and your colleagues did on the Iran-Iraq War and how that might impact our current political approach to Iran?
The Iran-Iraq War in the 1980s was the largest conventional war since the Korean War. It's also a war in which chemical weapons were used on a scale that we'd never seen since literally the First World War. 500,000 people were killed. Over 1 million were wounded. For Iranians, it is the defining issue of contemporary Iranian history. This, much more than their revolution, touched every single Iranian and became the centerpiece of the narrative of Iran's history. Iranians see the Iran-Iraq War, they call it the imposed war. It wasn't just the Iraqis who started the war in the Iranian narrative. The whole world backed them because of their revolution. And the United States in particular assisted the Iraqis. And that's true. We did. We provided Saddam Hussein's Iraq in the 1980s with critical intelligence support. And by the end of the war, we were actually a co-belligerent. Our Navy was sinking the Iranian Navy. But it's a much understudied subject in the United States. While Iranians think of it immediately, most Americans don't even remember the Iran-Iraq War. It's faded from our memory, partly because we supported Saddam Hussein's Iraq, and nobody really wants to remember that we supported Saddam Hussein's Iraq. So several scholars and I got together and came up with the idea, how can we study this war most effectively? The Critical Oral History Project is to bring together the policymakers, the decision makers who were actually engaged in the war. So we convened in Georgia a session with about a dozen or so of the most important American policymakers who were involved in decision making back in the 1980s, mostly in the Reagan administration, but beginning in the Clinton, beginning in the Carter administration. Put them together in a room for a weekend and have them talk about it. But to make it more structured, we also got as many documents about the war and American policy, many of which have been declassified since then, including intelligence estimates and internal documents, and gave them a binder with all the documents and an extensive chronology. And to make it even more critical, because it's not just oral history, we brought together some of the leading scholars, historians on the war, so that you had a conversation which was really three ways. The policymakers recounting their experiences and talking to each other. The documents talking to everyone as well, saying, well, your memory's a little bit off here, or the document's wrong. Either one can be true. And scholars who were saying, let me give you some context on it. And I think the result is a fascinating book that explains American policy during the war through the eyes of the people who were making it, but also through outside scholars looking back on it. For example, I persuaded the American intelligence officer who first brought intelligence to Baghdad in 1982 to give to the Saddam government to come to the conference. And he recounted the experience of doing that. When the airplane that flew him in from Amman, Jordan, landed in Baghdad, he didn't know whether he was going to be greeted as a friend bringing important information or be shot on the tarmac by the Iraqi government. And in fact, as he recounts in the book, there was a little bit of both. Some of the Iraqis did greet him as a potential useful ally, and others wanted to have nothing to do with the Central Intelligence Agency and thought this man should be imprisoned and locked away. So those kind of vignettes, I think, provide a way of understanding American decision-making and the consequences of those decisions, the unintended consequences. And the unintended consequences of American policy in the Iran-Iraq War are living with us to this day. Our tilt towards Iraq in the 1980s led directly to Iraq's invasion of Kuwait in 1990 and two Persian Gulf wars that have followed since then that just came to an end in 2010. And it also led to the enmity between the United States and Iran, which we live with to this day. Today, the president is engaged in a serious negotiating process with the Iranians to try to persuade Iran not to build a nuclear weapon. The alternative to that negotiating process would be another war. I think if you go back and look at some of the lessons of the Iran-Iraq war, you will be much more persuaded of the wisdom of trying the negotiations process. Our first war with Iran in the 1980s was a scarring experience for the Iranians, but it also had a lot of scarring experiences for us. The Iranians fought back, not just in the Persian Gulf, but in places like Lebanon, where they blew our embassy up twice, in Saudi Arabia, where they blew up one of our military bases years after the war was over. It's also a sobering understanding of many of our allies. Back in the Iran-Iraq war, for example, the Saudis told us to support Iraq. And were constantly pressing us to be more and more supportive of Iraq. Well, within a few years, of course, Iraq was on the verge of invading Saudi Arabia. So maybe their advice isn't always worth taking so much. The Israelis during the Iran-Iraq war encouraged us to support the Iranians. The whole idea of trading arms for hostages in the 1980s, which led to the Iran-Contra scandal, originated with the Israelis. Again, maybe the advice of our allies isn't always the best advice, and we ought to come up with our own thinking. Of course we want to listen to our allies. Of course they have a lot to offer. But perhaps their advice isn't always the be's all and end all.
An analysis of the context of the advice is always advisable.
Along those lines, and do you see, particularly these negotiations, the election of President Hassan Rouhani, as a major shift in Iranian approach to the United States and to the West? I mean, we just came off of Ahmadinejad, who certainly was in a much different mold. And the figure that spans both of the course is Khamenei, who is the Ayatollah, who was comfortable with Ahmadinejad and is also now comfortable with Iran. Is there a shift in thinking now for the leadership of the Iran? And if so, why is that shift taking place?
The short answer is it's too soon to tell.
Too soon to tell, okay.
but it's a very important question. And let me just make a footnote here. If you look at the lives of Ahmadinejad, Rouhani, Khamenei, they were all shaped by the Iran-Iraq War. This was, for many of them, relatively early in their life, in their 30s, 20s in some cases. This is the event that shaped them. They saw their friends and classmates die in this war. And it shaped their perception of us. And I think what we're seeing in Iran now is an argument between those who say, let's not take a risk on another war like that, and those who are willing to take that risk. The sanctions that we have put on Iran in the last several years have had a serious bite. But I think bigger than that is the question, do they want to face another war with the United States of America? And I think that there is certainly a part of the Iranian political elite, led by Rouhani, which is trying to find an alternative path. They may not work. These negotiations are going to be very, very complex, and they deal with the question of how close to having a working weapon are we prepared to live? We're past the point where Iran can be walked back to not having any knowledge of how to make a bomb. Those days are gone. They know how to do it. They figured it out. The question is going to be, at what level in that process will they stop, and can we be confident that if they change their mind, we'll know about it right away? And that's a technical issue in many ways, but it's also a political issue. What are we willing to live with? What level of risk are we willing to live with? And I think that if you look back at the Iran-Iraq War and at the rest of America's encounter with Iran since the revolution in 1979, it's pretty sobering. And a military operation against Iran is not going to be an airstrike. It's not going to be something that happens and is over in an evening. We could find ourselves in an open-ended conflict. One of my colleagues at Brookings likes to say, if you liked the war with Iraq, you're going to love the war with Iran because it's going to be five times bigger than the war with Iraq.
Well, our issue with Iran to some degree spills over also into Syria, doesn't it? And how do you see, Bruce, what is going on in Syria and our approach to both Iran's position on Syria and our own?
The Syrian conflict is a terrible tragedy, maybe the most terrible tragedy of our day. There are many players now up to no good in Syria, starting with, of course, the president of Syria, Bashar Assad, who is a mass murderer, brutally murdering his own people. The Iranians are helping him. The Russians are helping him. The revolution against him started as a genuinely peaceful movement, but as time has gone on, it has been corrupted as well, and we now have al-Qaeda deeply involved in this Syrian civil war. Unfortunately, I don't think there's a made-in-America solution to this problem. I don't think putting American troops into Syria makes any sense. And I also think there is not likely to be a short outcome here. Next door in Lebanon, they faced a very similar crisis back in the 1970s that led to the Lebanese Civil War that went on more or less continuously for a quarter of a century. I certainly hope the Syrian Civil War doesn't go on for a quarter of a century, but if the Lebanese preview is any historical analogy, we're in for this for a very, very long time to come. We should do all we can to minimize the terrible human suffering. And most of all, we should try to ensure to the extent that we can that it not spread further into Syria's neighbors. It's already spread into Iraq and it's spreading into Lebanon. But we have the capacity, I think, to make sure that it doesn't spread to other places like Turkey, Israel, and Jordan. And Jordan is the most vulnerable. Jordan already has over 500,000 Syrian refugees in the country. And we know from bitter experience that refugee camps in the Middle East produce terrorism. Maybe not overnight, but when those young kids who've lost their home, lost everything, grow up in a few years, they will be bitter and angry young men who will join groups like al-Qaeda or Hezbollah or groups like that. We need to make sure that we've done everything we can to contain the civil war and to ensure that in the refugee camps in Jordan and in Turkey and other places, we're not unintentionally producing the next generation of Osama bin Ladens and terrorists like that.
I was curious about how you see the trajectory of what I guess is the sort of the modern era of terrorism with al-Qaeda. And in some places, such as, for instance, in Iraq, there was a pushback against al-Qaeda. What role do you see these kinds of organizations, not just al-Qaeda, playing in the Middle East? And is there a point at which whatever advantages or whatever attractions there are, it dissipates, as we've seen, for instance, we saw initially certainly in Iraq. We now see certainly a pushback from some what's been called anyway moderate groups in Syria. Where do you see that strain going, or are we going to be living with it for another decade or two? I mean, or does it burn out?
Unfortunately, I think we are going to be living with it for a long time to come. My first book on the search for al-Qaeda, I tried to explain the narrative of al-Qaeda or answer the question, why do they hate us? And the reasons for that are many and deep and are not subject to quick solutions or overnight solutions. The Arab Spring gave new vitality to al-Qaeda. Because it broke down law and order, because it created chaos, al-Qaeda was able to flourish. And we're seeing that from Algeria to Syria to Iraq. But al-Qaeda, at the end of the day, is a ideology that is a fantasy. What do I mean by that? They are not going to build a new caliphate from Morocco to Indonesia. It's not going to happen. The people of the Muslim world don't want it. They know what an al-Qaeda-like system is. It's the medieval hell that the Taliban created in Afghanistan in the 1990s. Very, very few Muslims really want that. So I think in the end there will be, and we've seen it in some places already, a counter-movement, a resistance, an attack on it. Not just because of the savagery of al-Qaeda's tactics, but because the narrative, the ideology, in the end doesn't add up to anything that people really want. We've seen that blowback in Iraq. We've seen it in Saudi Arabia. We've seen it in Jordan. We've seen it in the past in Egypt. The one place we've never seen it, though, is Pakistan, which is why I argue Pakistan is really the epicenter of all of this. Certainly, there's every reason for blowback. The Pakistan is a country that suffered terribly from terrorism in the last decade, and yet there hasn't been much blowback from it. And that goes to some of the peculiarities of Pakistan, the role the military plays, but also the role the United States has played in Pakistan.
Bruce, how important in all of this is the Israeli peace treaty with the Palestinians? What role does that play?
If you study the life history of the leaders of al-Qaeda, Osama bin Laden and now Ayman Zawahiri, if you read what they write, for them the creation of Israel is the biggest sin in their eyes that the West has imposed on the Muslim world. That's not an argument that they're right. It's an argument that's what they say. That's what their own writings are about. So I think that a just, fair, and lasting solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict that provides security for Israelis as well as a state for Palestinians is the critical soft power ingredient in dealing with all of these problems. It's not going to produce a peace-loving, bucolic Middle East overnight. There are many other reasons why the Middle East is a violent place, but it's one of the most important. And I think in that sense, Secretary Kerry is absolutely right to be putting so much effort into this. A lot of people say, chances are so slim. Why are you devoting so much effort to what is a long shot? I think John Kerry would answer that because if we succeed, the results are so important in so many different things over time, it will have been worth taking that gamble.
Bruce, you're working on a new book, and I understand it's in the final editing process and will be out fairly soon. Tell us about what you're thinking about in this new book.
My new book that's coming out this spring is entitled What We Won, America's Secret War in Afghanistan, 1979 to 1989. And it comes from spending a lot of time in the last few years looking at the situation in Afghanistan, the war, which is now the longest war in American history, a very controversial war. How did we get into Afghanistan? How did we get there? Well, the answer is a secret covert war that we fought in the 1970s and 1980s against the Russians. At the end of that war, the CIA station chief in Islamabad, Pakistan, who was their tactical commander on the ground, famously sent a cable back to Langley. Subject matter, war in Afghanistan. Paragraph one, we won. Paragraph two, end of message. It is the most successful intelligence operation the United States has ever carried out. We did win. We defeated the Soviet Union's 40th Red Army in Afghanistan. And almost immediately after that, the Berlin Wall fell. Communism was removed from Eastern Europe. and the Soviet Union fell apart. But we also know now the global jihad began. And going back and looking at that operation and how it was conducted, who was involved, who our allies were, who the Russians were, and the role of two presidents, Carter and Reagan, I think is useful for understanding where we are today, where we're going in Afghanistan, and also useful for thinking about intelligence operations. The war in Afghanistan cost the American taxpayer about $3 billion. Not a single American was killed in fighting in the war. If you want to look at federal government projects that had big bang for relatively few bucks, I would argue this may be the most successful federal government project in history. But it had unintended consequences, which are serious and significant. What lessons can we learn about that? There are many who advocate today arming the Syrian opposition, for example. Well, what lessons did we learn from arming the Afghan opposition, the Mujahideen, in the 1980s that might be relevant to the Syrian experience?
Well, in the few minutes that we have left, I also understand that you're thinking about the next book as well. And that's kind of fascinating too. Tell us in a few moments what you're thinking about in that book and your interest in the Kennedy administration that prompts it.
The Kennedy administration is one of the most interesting in American history. We all know the story of the Cuban Missile Crisis, when we went eyeball to eyeball with the Russians and narrowly avoided nuclear war. At that time that crisis was going on, another crisis was going on in South Asia. China invaded India. John F. Kennedy had to deal with two huge crises at the same time. The second crisis has largely been forgotten by Americans. And yet, it set the stage for what may want to be one of the most important developments of the 21st century, rivalry between the two biggest countries in the world, India and China. How did it start? What role did the Americans play in it? What role did Kennedy play in it? And how has that rivalry between China and India developed since then? And what does it hold for the future? And that's what this book idea will be all about.
Well, have you decided yet on your one-page outline and your one-paragraph conclusion in terms of the way you write where this book is going to go?
Pretty much. I think I have a pretty good idea. What I find fascinating, and it's become a joint effort with my wife, Elizabeth, is we are now reliving Camelot. We're reading every book you can find about JFK and Jackie Kennedy. Jackie plays an important role in this story because in the 1,000 days, John F. Kennedy never went to South Asia. Jackie Kennedy did. And when she went to India and Pakistan in 1962, she was greeted as a rock star and had tremendous influence on the Indian and Pakistani leaders. So it's a fascinating era to go back into and look at. And it also involves another very, very secret CIA intelligence operation, which began in the 1950s in Tibet, to arm the Tibetan rebels against the Chinese government. The thesis of the book, or as you like to say, the Hercule Poirot moment in the book, is that it was probably that operation that sparked the Chinese invasion and created the war in 1962.
Wow. Bruce, you're truly a great asset to our country. And I think we all take comfort in the work that you do and in the knowledge that people like you are listened to by those who make the political decisions that impact and affect our lives. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me today.
Well, thank you for being here today and for sharing your fantastic insights with us. We greatly appreciate it. Okay, all you essay writers out there and you political analysis that send me your writings on the internet almost every day now. A number of imperatives for you. Know your field of inquiry thoroughly. Know it thoroughly. Sharpen your mental processes. No clumsy thinking allowed. Be clear and direct with your writing. No obfuscation. And finally, know where you're going. Know what the end is going to be before you begin. I'm your host, Harold Wilson. Thank you, and thank you, Don, also, for sitting in with us today. Thank you for listening to Delmarva Today, Writer's Edition.
You've been listening to a special Writer's Edition of Delmarva Today with their host, Harold Wilson. This program is produced on the campus of Salisbury University for Delmarva Public Radio. Christopher Rank is your audio engineer. Mary Seaman is the volunteer producer. Visit our website, delmarvapublicradio.net, for podcasts of this program.